All right, so this is Bio 241, and it's November sometime.
November 12th.
Okay, and we're going to have a test next week. We're scheduled to have it on Tuesday. And it's going to be over chapters 12 and 13, just those two chapters. They're kind of long chapters, so it's okay. It's just on those two chapters. All right, a lot of students have come to me and said that they would prefer to have it on Thursday instead of Tuesday. All right, and I don't know if that's such a good idea or not, to tell you the truth, because that week I have to calculate everybody's grade, because the drop date is at the end of that week. So if we take a test on Thursday, I don't know if I'd be able to calculate everybody's course grade. For instance, if I had to give you a grade at the end of next week, what would it be? All right, so I got to get all the information from the lab instructors and things like that. So that would be a little tight, all right, but it's possible for me to do that. So maybe I will just ask who would not want to have it on Thursday? Who needs to have it on Tuesday? Some people need to have it on Tuesday. Yeah. So I think we're going to keep it on Tuesday. All right? We'll keep it on Tuesday. Because Yeah, well, that makes it really difficult on some people. All right? Because, for all kinds of different reasons. Right? And I can't really balance out the reasons. It's just not a... It's not the balance of mass, right? So some of the reasons are really good. Maybe people are made plans to leave town or something, so it's really difficult. Okay, so we're going to have it on Tuesday over those two chapters. All right, and please, no retribution on students that need to have it on Tuesday, because that's how it's on the schedule right there. All right, other comment I want to make is that I've been putting lectures back online as of last night sometime, because I wasn't able to FTP. I had a computer that break, and then I had on and on and on, had to transfer the website over to another computer and redefine the site and get transfer privileges. So that is happening now. So hopefully everything is back to normal in terms of the website if you want to go and listen to lectures online, all right, including this one that we're going to have today. All right, so that's the deal. So next week, you'll know if I had to give you a grade at the end of the test, what that grade would be, and you can talk to me and make up your mind how if you want to stay in the class. But typically for this class, everybody's grade grows sort of exponentially. All right, a lot of students did really well on that last test. I don't know if we had many hundreds or not. I can't remember. Maybe not exactly, but a lot of A's, a lot of high grades. So congratulations, you're learning what to study for the test and actually doing that. So that's really nice. Okay. Say that again. I'm going to keep those grades. Usually in this class, grades get better and better and better with each subsequent test. Okay, so that's typically how it goes. Yeah. Will I drop the lowest grade, like for exams? Oh, unfortunately, I can't do that, but maybe next semester I would. If students find that really helpful, then I would have to change the mode of the class around. Sometimes I do that, but in order to drop a test grade, then you need to have a final that's comprehensive. So you're tested over the whole material once again. So this class is so important, there isn't a segment of information that you should not know. All the information on every test is important. Okay, so no, I won't drop a test grade, but if you prefer to have a cumulative test and then be able to drop one test, maybe you should let me know and I would redo the class next time. Okay, so, but there are a lot of good reasons to have a cumulative final exam, so it's not something that I'm against. I kind of like it, actually. Yeah. Uh-huh.
But,
Yeah, that's up to every, it's up to every lab instructor, and that's something I don't frown upon. So, because you have a lot of quizzes during the semester, sometimes you can't be there for every lab, so I'll certainly allow one lab to be dropped. That's a little problematic on Monday's class, because you have so many holidays. Oh, this isn't a Monday class, though. Okay, never mind that one. Okay, because Tuesdays and Thursdays It might be a little bit of a problem for Thursday's class because you have a holiday on one Thursday, right? In 2 weeks, I believe. Okay. All right, so is that it for questions, pretty much? All right, so we were talking about the heart. Make sure that you don't forget any of your heart anatomy, right? Because we're talking about the different chambers, different valves, and all that kind of stuff, the interventricular septum, as well as the blood flow patterns through the heart. So you should be able to trace a drop of blood through the circulation, the two circulations, trace it through every chamber, past every valve, and be able to state what the oxygen concentration is of that drop of blood in each of those pieces of the circulation. Right? If you can do that, then you have really a nice crystal clear idea of the circulation of the heart and what it's doing. And that will be important because we're going to probably finish the class with the respiratory chapter, the lungs, and the pulmonary circulation is certainly an important part of that chapter as well. All right, so we talked a little bit about cardiac muscle in the previous chapter, but there's just a few other things that we need to say about it. And we started talking about it last time, and we saw two different kinds of action potentials. And you might actually find it very helpful to be able to draw out just on a blank piece of paper what those different action potentials look like depending on the kinds of cells that produce them in the heart. So if you think of all the different cells in the heart, it can be made up of two different kinds of myocytes. There are certain myocytes that are specialized for contraction, which is generally what we attribute muscle cells to do. But there's another kind of muscle cell in the heart that is not specialized for contraction. It's specialized to conduct action potentials, and there's special kinds of action potentials. All right, so what kind of muscle cell is specialized for transmitting special kinds of action potentials? What kind of tissue do we call that? That's a nodal cell or nodal tissue. So these are really myocytes, right? But they are not really specialized for contracting. They transmit electrical information, and that's what I have. Do I have the projector on? Indeed, I do. That's what I have on the projector right now. Let's maybe make it a little bit dimmer. Does that help?
Yeah.
A little bit? That's a little too dark probably, huh? Okay. So let's look at the nodal pathways for inside the heart, and then we'll talk about what it's doing inside the heart. And then we'll look at some overall electrical events of the heart. All right, so we said that the nodal cells have pacemaker potentials. All right, so you should be able to discuss with me what this pacemaker potential is all about. What ion is involved? And where is it going? It's due to a sodium ion. Okay, and how come that sodium ion is moving? Because in these nodal cells, there's a special sodium channel that is always a little leaky. We call that an HCN channel. It always allows for a little bit of sodium to trickle inside the cell. And when sodium enters a cell, what's a classical understanding of electrophysiology? What happens to the voltage of that cell? It depolarizes, right? The transmembrane potential depolarizes, and when it reaches threshold, then of course, in this particular cell, the membrane channels that cause depolarization are voltage-gated calcium channels. They open up, and then calcium rushes inside the cell that rapidly depolarizes these nodal cells, and that's the beginning of an action potential, right? Once a membrane potential reaches threshold, and then repolarization is due to the similar kinds of potassium channels that you're familiar with. And this process repeats itself over and over and over again because these HCN channels means or makes the nodal tissues autorhythmic, right? They will generate their own action potentials depending on the slope of this pacemaker potential right here. The more sodium channels that are open, guess what happens to the slope of this pacemaker potential? Does it get steeper or more shallow if more sodium channels open up? It gets steeper, so an action potential is generated at a faster pace, and so the heart rate increases when that happens. All right, so this is a nice typical kind of action potential you see with nodal tissue as opposed to this kind of action potential. This is what we see from the contractile cells of the myocardium. And it has calcium channels in it, right? But these calcium channels are slow. They don't cause depolarization, but they cause this plateau region. And this plateau region extends the absolute refractory period of the myocardium. So how does that protect the heart? Or how does that protect the individual when the absolute refractory period is extended due to these calcium channels right here? That prevents the heart from going into tetanus, okay? A sustained contraction. So the heart cannot sustain a contraction because all of the cells of the heart are in this plateau, if the heart is functioning normally, are in this plateau region. And remember, what about an action potential? Can action potential summate? They cannot summate. And since action potentials can't summate, then the myocardium cannot be forced into another contraction. All right, so that prevents the heart from going into tetany, and that's a really good thing because your heart can only be in tetany. Say if it could go into tetany, if your heart stops beating, how long can you stay alive for if your heart stops beating? 3 minutes and your brain is dead, right? So that would be terrible. So this is a good protective mechanism. All right, so let's look at the more gross anatomy of nodal tissue inside the heart. The normal pacemaker is the sinoatrial node at the junction of the superior vena cava and the superior roof of the right atrium right here. This part of the heart has the HCN channels producing the steepest slope of that pacemaker potential. So these depolarize the fastest. Right, and since they depolarize the fastest, this acts as a pacemaker. It captures the whole heart because when electrical information or when an action potential starts in one part of the heart, where does it end up? How does it go from one place to another? It can travel through the whole myocardium because the myocardium is what we call a functional syncytium because there are sodium channels that interconnect all cells. What do we call those sodium channels? Gap junctions within the intercalated discs. Okay. There's only one place in the heart where you don't have gap junctions between neighboring cells, and that is the fibrous myocardium, right, which separates the atria from the ventricles. And that fibrous part of the myocardium is important because it anchors the valves in place, but it also prevents electrical activity from spontaneously moving from the atrium into the ventricles. And this is where nodal tissue plays another role in controlling the heart rate and the function of the heart. All right, so since the SA node depolarizes first, and depolarization is a signal for contraction, right, because of excitation-contraction coupling that we talked about already in the last chapter, right, since action potentials are generated in the atria before the ventricles, what can you tell me about contraction? Does contraction happen first in the ventricles or first in the atria or maybe exactly at the same time? The atria first, right? So the job of the atria are to help filling of the ventricles. So the atria contract first because that's where the normal pacemaker is, the SA node. So the atria pump blood into the ventricles and then at a later time, right, about 100 milliseconds later, the ventricles contract and then it pumps all of that blood into what kind of vessel? Into what takes blood away from the heart? Arteries, right? Then the ventricles pump blood into arteries. The right ventricle pumps it into the pulmonary trunk. Left ventricle pumps it into the aorta, right? Okay. So that fibrous myocardium does not allow electrical signals to enter the ventricle. So there is special nodal tissue starting with the atrioventricular node right here that receives those action potentials, and the AV node is kind of special because it holds on to those action potentials. It's slow to react. It acts as a delay line, but this tissue delays the entry of action potentials into the ventricles. This allows the atria to contract first, and then after a short period of time, The action potentials then move through the atrioventricular bundle through the fibrous skeleton of the heart. Right? This is a special pathway for action potentials to enter the ventricle. And as a matter of fact, this is the only way that action potentials can enter the ventricles from the atria. And then, right, from the atrioventricular bundle proceeds down through the bundle branches that we have right here, and the transmission of action potentials is very fast through the interventricular septum. So action potentials reach the apex of the heart very rapidly, and then they're disseminated via these Purkinje fibers, and the Purkinje fibers then cause depolarization of all of the myocytes down in the apex, and then, right, depolarization sweeps up the free walls back up toward the base of the heart after the apex receives action potentials. So again, right, the ventricles contract in a certain way as well. Since the apex depolarizes before the more basilar regions of the ventricles depolarize, guess which part of the myocardium of the ventricles contract first? The apical region or the basilar regions right here? The apical regions, because the apical regions have these Purkinje fibers, right? And then the basilar parts, right, are stimulated, receive action potentials at a slightly later time. So the apex contracts first, and that makes really good sense, because as the apex contracts, it forces blood from the apex up toward the base, and what do you have connected to the base of the heart? That's where you have the pulmonary trunk and the aorta, so blood is pumped from the ventricles into the arteries. If the more basilar regions of the ventricles contracted first, it would force blood down into the apex, and where would it go once it got into the apex? It couldn't go anywhere, right? So it would not be a very efficient pump. So because of the conduction system right here, first the atria contract, helping fill the ventricles, then the apical regions of the ventricles contract, forcing blood up toward the base, out the arteries, the great vessels, the great arteries coming off the base of the heart. Okay, so make sure you know your anatomy of that conduction system, and you should then be aware of how the heart contracts. All right, so first the SA node depolarizes. That depolarization sweeps over both atria. All right, so both atria depolarize. That signals them to contract. That forces blood from the atria into the ventricles. And then depolarization goes through the AB node, into the AB bundle, down the bundle branches to the apex of the heart. That causes the apex of the heart to depolarize first, which signals the apex to contract. So the apex contracts before the more superior regions of the ventricles, and that forces blood out the pulmonary artery and the aorta. Right. So that's the best way to think of the conduction system of the heart. All right, so I'm going to end the show. Let's take a look at let's see if this is helpful. The conduction system of the heart. All right, so here we see, what is this right here? SA node, and this is the AV node, and then here is the? Bundle of His, or AV bundle, and then here you can see the bundle branches. So depolarization sweeps very rapidly down through the interventricular septum to these Purkinje fibers. The Purkinje fibers then distribute action potentials through the wall of the myocardium. All right, so let's see if we can see how this works. All right, so there is the action potential moving through both atria. All right, and it reaches the AV node where it's delayed. All right, so it depolarizes, but it's delayed. So now what happens is the atria contract. I don't see them contracting. And then the electrical signal moves very rapidly down through the atrioventricular bundle and bundle branches, right, to the Purkinje fibers. And after the atria contract, the ventricles contract. There it moves very rapidly down to the Purkinje fibers. That spreads depolarization through the whole myocardium once it reaches the Purkinje fibers. All right, so let's see if the heart contracts. Is it contracting? Ah, there we go. All right, so atria contract followed by the ventricles, right? All right, so you'll have a link in your Blackboard for that illustration, and you can even listen to the narrative. Maybe you were reading the captions. All right, but that's basically just what I said. Okay, so let's go back to some of these other slides. Okay. All right, so don't forget, the AV node delays the signal into the ventricles. All right, then the bundle branches, it's very, very fast. It spreads that action potential very rapidly. All right, so sometimes somebody will have a heart attack and it will kill this part of the heart. Right, or maybe it will actually kill the atrioventricular node. And so now there is no way for action potentials to leave the atria and enter the ventricles. What happens to somebody when this nodal tissue is destroyed and no longer can conduct action potentials? What happens to the heart? Okay. Then the atria will contract according to their own rhythm, which is determined by the SA node, and the ventricles will contract according to their own rhythm, determined by an ectopic pacemaker that will develop from a myocyte or some nodal tissue in the ventricles. And it will be at a slower rate. So the atria will contract with one kind of rhythm, and the ventricles will contract with another kind of rhythm. We would maybe call that bigeminy. That happens actually fairly frequently, and clinically it's not too important because the job of the atria is not really too significant. It hardly pumps any blood into the ventricles. Most of the time during diastole, blood returning via the vena cava pass right through the atria into the ventricles, filling the ventricles up. It's only a last little bit of blood when the atria contract weakly help fill the ventricles up. All right, so that's not such a serious condition. So any of these tissues in the myocardium can generate pacemaker potentials, but it's usually the SA node that captures the whole heart because that has the fastest autorhythmic property of the whole heart. All right, so excitation-contraction coupling is fairly similar compared to skeletal muscle. We've talked about it already. All right, but the sarcolemma has voltage-gated calcium channels, so they open up when the plasma membranes depolarize. And then that depolarization opens up calcium-induced calcium release channels in the sarcoplasmic reticulum, which then releases a lot more calcium, which binds to troponin, right? And then that stimulates contraction, as in skeletal muscle, because troponin then moves tropomyosin out of the way for cross bridges to form, right? And then during repolarization, that calcium is pumped back out of the cell into the interstitial space and also into the sarcoplasmic reticulum. And as calcium levels decrease around actin and myosin filaments, and cross bridges can't form, and the heart relaxes as a result. All right, so this slide right here just shows, right, it's a plot of voltage versus time. That's one of the axes for this line right here, which kind of looks like a green line to me. Is that kind of greenish? Okay, that's the action potential. So that's a measure of voltage, right? But we see another graph superimposed on this one, and it looks kind of red to me. Does that look red to you? The red line, that is not voltage, but that's a tension measurement, right? So that's measured with a transducer that can actually measures tension produced by the muscle. So this actually shows you contraction of the heart. And what can you tell me about the relationship between depolarization and contraction? Do they happen at exactly the same time? Can you think of Can you see cause and effect right here? Is tension causing a change in voltage, or is a change in membrane potential causing a change in tension? What happens first? Here is a time axis right here. What happens first? Curve A or curve B? Curve A, right? So that is the action potential. Depolarization causes the muscle to contract. Right, so muscle contraction doesn't cause the voltage to change. The voltage of the heart causes the heart to contract. So voltage changes always precede contraction. And we can see that the absolute refractory period of this action potential, right, just does not allow the heart to go into tetany, because these action potentials cannot summate. Right, so the heart has to relax completely before another action potential can stimulate the heart to contract once again. All right, so that's the importance of what this plateau region in the action potential. And of course, you should know what's causing that plateau region. Who can remember what that plateau region is caused by?
Calcium.
Yeah, those special calcium channels, which are slow, right, to open up. All right. Well, your heart has millions and millions and millions of cells that make it up, and all those millions of cells will depolarize pretty much all at the same time, right? So here we have a graph of voltage, right, versus time. One voltage that we see on this top graph is a voltage that we actually measure from the surface of a person with surface electrodes. And sometimes I suppose we could use needle electrodes if we wanted a really precise measurement, right? But surface electrodes suffice in most circumstances. Okay, what kind did you use in lab? Did you do ECGs in lab yet? Yeah, probably. Did you use needle electrodes? Subcutaneous needle electrodes, or just surface electrodes? Yeah, just probably surface electrodes. And what were the ECGs like? Pretty nice, probably, right? No, you didn't. You had a hard time measuring them, or what? They were pretty easy to measure, right? And so here is an ECG. Right, because of all those millions of cells that make up the myocardium, all those cells are depolarizing with this kind of action potential. All of that voltage will summate, will travel through the body, because your body is made up of a lot of electrolytes, so it's very easy for electrical signals to move through your body and reach the surface where they're measured with those surface electrodes. And you get something that looks like this. Right, so that is the electrocardiogram, right? And electrocardiogram can be spelled a couple different ways. Sometimes cardio is spelled with a C, sometimes it's spelled with a K. And what's the difference between them? Absolutely none, right? And you might be in a hospital someplace walking down the hallway, and there might be a sign for an electrocardiography or electrocardiogram spelled with a C, and you turn the corner, and then all of a sudden they spell it with a K. Okay, so they're exactly synonymous. The K is just an older European way of spelling cardio compared to the C. The C is a little bit more modern term, not so old. But it means exactly the same thing. So as all of these millions of action potentials reach the surface of your body, you can measure them with surface electrodes, right? And it produces these different waveforms, right? And the waveforms in a normal ECG are the P, the QRS complex, and the T wave. So basically three waves right here. The P wave represents, right, depolarization of the atria. Because what part of the heart depolarizes first? Atria, because of what special nodal tissue? The SA node is the normal pacemaker of the heart. Okay. So the P wave represents atrial depolarization, and this diagram is not really so good, because here we see that this square represents atrial contractions. Well, the atria doesn't really contract until what? Until after the P wave, more in this region right here, because this ECG is a signal for contraction. It's not really a measure of contraction. You'd have to measure that with a force transducer. Okay, and then what happens after depolarization? Repolarization has to take place, and we don't see that very well in the electrocardiogram. Atrial repolarization takes place at the same time that the ventricles depolarize. And what can you tell me about the mass of the atria compared to the mass of both ventricles? Which has more cells? The ventricles or the atria? Yeah, the atria are really thin. They're even thinner than the right ventricle. They don't produce much of a signal. That's why this P wave is so small. So when the ventricles depolarize, it obliterates the signal for atrial repolarization. We can't really see it. There's no way to separate it out. A way to think about that is if you walk outside right now, are there stars up in the sky? Are there stars up there? They're up there. Some people are shaking your head no, but you know what? They're still there. They don't go away. But if you look up at the sky, can you see them?
No.
The reason why you said no is because you can't see them. And why can't you see them? Because the sun is way too bright, right? So the same reason right here, we can't see a wave for atrial repolarization because the signal for ventricular depolarization is just too big to see it. I mean, that's a dynamic range problem, okay? The ventricular depolarization is too bright a signal for us to see anything about atrial repolarization. All right, so this means that the QRS complex is due to depolarization, right, of the ventricles, right? This, where I have the arrow right now, how would you describe this line from here to here? How would you describe that line? That's depolarization of the ventricles, right? And you could tell me what ions are moving there, what channels are opening or closing or whatever, right? So that's just what? Those are sodium channels that are opening, right? And so that causes the QRS complex right here, right? And so this QRS complex is just the sum of all those millions of cells that are depolarizing, maybe not at exactly the same time, but as it sweeps over the ventricles. And then we see the plateau region due to those slow calcium channels. And then how would you describe this descending slope of the action potential? This is repolarization. And now that produces another electrical event on the surface of our body that we call the T wave right here. Okay, so QRS is ventricular depolarization plus what else? I don't know if the book talks about it in this atrial repolarization, but it should. All right, so QRS is depolarization of the ventricles as well as repolarization of the atria. The T wave is purely repolarization of the ventricles. And the P wave right here is just due to depolarization of the atria. Now, why do you think they call that the P wave? I never looked that up. Somebody could do a Google on that.
Because ABC, we were already used for mathematical formulas.
Okay, that could be. Other letters were used first. Okay, but why not M? Or N, well, that's used in math. P used in math, physics, pressure, all right, that routinely. But in another language, what means the first event? The first event of a day? Like, yeah, primera, okay? So that's probably why somebody names this. This is the first one. This is the premier event of the myocardium. So let's just call it the P wave, all right? And then to keep from getting confused, what would be the next wave? Q. I don't know. Q doesn't relate to any kind of language as far as I know. It just follows P, right? All right, so QRS complex and then T is the last one. T doesn't make sense either. But if you think of P being that first wave, that certainly makes sense. All right, so I think we talked about all this stuff already. Remember, the ECG waveforms are not a measure of contraction. They're strictly what kind of events? They're electrical events, right? And the myocardium then will contract as long as it's healthy and you have proper excitation-contraction coupling taking place, right? All right. What do you call a machine that acquires and records an ECG? Oh, I forgot. What do you call that? Oh, I remember. It's a electrocardiograph, all right? And what does an electrocardiograph produce? Electrocardiograms, right? So just think of what's the difference between a telegraph and a telegram. This is way before your time, but that's how people used to talk to each other across country, right, with telegrams. So a telegraph is the machine you'd click out Morse code with, and it'd go through some wires, and you would get to the other end of the country, and somebody would have to take those little clicks and actually write down the words and produce a telegram, okay? So a telegram is the information. The telegraph is the machine. Same thing. Electrocardiograph is the machine. Electrocardiogram is the ECG on a piece of paper. All right, so which events occur first in the heart? The mechanical events, contraction, or electrical events? Okay, the electrical events, and you could explain to somebody why. In very short way of explaining it, how could you explain that? Why do the electrical events precede or cause the mechanical events? Yeah, because excitation-contraction coupling has to work in order for a muscle to contract. All right, so various ion channels have to open up that's produced by the electrical event. Calcium has to be released from the sarcoplasmic reticulum via calcium channels and enter the cell from calcium channels. All right, and then what does calcium do? It has to bind to troponin, and then what has to happen? Tropomyosin has to move out of the way, and then what happens when tropomyosin's moved out of the way? Myosin head group has to bind to the actin molecule, right? So there's a lot of steps before the muscle can actually contract after that electrical signal is presented to it. Okay. All right, so this is a pretty handy diagram to see how depolarization and repolarization takes place on the heart. All right, I think we kind of talked about this slide already a little bit. I think we looked at a graph that shows pressure versus time, electrical activity versus time, heart sounds versus time, and maybe even volume changes of the heart over time. All right, so make sure you know, and you can, you have to memorize this. This is probably something you should memorize, right, that the first heart sound is due to closing of the AV valves. The second heart sound is closing of the semilunar valves. But if you can appreciate that, if you can figure that out by looking at pressure and volume curves, that's even better. And the place to start right there is you have to know how a fluid moves. How would you describe how a fluid moves? From high pressure to low pressure, right? So if you think of the two chambers, atria and ventricles, blood will flow from an atria to a ventricle when the atrial pressure is higher or lower than a ventricle. It's got to be higher, right? Blood will flow from atria to ventricle when the ventricles, for instance, are contracting, the pressure goes up. Blood will want to flow backwards from a ventricle back into the atria when the ventricles contract. But of course, that would kill the heart. So the atrioventricular valves close at that point in time. That's the first heart sound. Then the ventricles contract, right? We call that systole. Right, and that forces a lot of blood into the aorta, so the pressure in the aorta goes up to systolic pressure, like 120 would be a good example. And then as the ventricles relax, the pressure in the ventricles decrease. The pressure in the aorta is still the same, so blood will try to flow backward from an aorta into a ventricle, but that will kill the heart. So what happens? The aortic valve has to close, right? And that produces the second heart sound right here. All right, so let's look at the structure of some blood vessels. Oh, but you know what? I'm asking you to do this on your own. Okay, well, let's maybe answer some of these questions really quick. Material can enter or leave the blood only through what kind of blood vessel? Capillary. A capillary. All right. What structure regulates blood flow through a capillary? Oh, we haven't talked about that. Maybe in anatomy we haven't even talked about that. But there is a circular smooth muscle at the entrance to every capillary bed. And does anybody know what a general name for a circular smooth muscle is? It's a sphincter, right? And so those sphincters can contract and they can dilate, and that controls blood flow through a capillary. Don't talk about this much in anatomy either. Name the two mechanisms which help return blood to the heart. So we're talking about blood, which is a fluid. It's going to flow according to what? It's going to flow according to what physical parameter? Okay, skeletal muscle is a structure. But what physical parameter is going to make fluid flow from one place to another? Pressure. Yeah, pressure. So there's got to be a pressure difference. Right, but we said that the pressure in the heart is very, very low. The atria is really, really low. How is blood going to flow back from a vein, which is very low pressure, back to the heart? It needs an assist. There are like two false hearts that are pumping venous blood back to the heart. Okay, and I guess I have some slides in here. Maybe I'll go take a look at these slides. There are, oh, these are all things that I could show you right here. Okay. All right, the first thing is the skeletal muscle pump, which is what you were speaking about. All right, so here we have a vein. All right, so blood is going to flow through this vein back to the heart, but the pressure is very, very low in veins. So it doesn't have much motivation to move back to the heart by itself. But veins have another special structure in them that arteries do not. And these structures are very similar to what we see in the heart. They are these flaps right here. So what do these flaps do? Yeah, it prevents retrograde flow of blood, right? So these are valves. And it allows blood only to flow back toward the heart, not back down to an extremity. All right, so when blood flows back to the heart, they open up, flows back to the heart, they open up. And when blood starts to flow back down to an extremity, these cusps fill up with blood and it closes off the valves. It occludes this blood vessel. Okay. So how does blood move from this chamber here to this one up over here? It's got to be at a higher pressure than this chamber up over here. And what produces a higher pressure in this chamber right here is that this vein is going to be inside of a skeletal muscle, and when skeletal muscle contracts, it gets bigger and thicker, and it compresses this segment of the vein. It pressurizes this part of the vein, so blood is going to want to squirt back down, but also back up toward the heart. But what's the only way that it can go? It can only go back to the heart when this segment is pressurized, because this valve is preventing the retrograde flow of blood. All right, so that's what we call the skeletal muscle pump. So anytime you use skeletal muscle in your body, it's squishing down veins, which is pumping venous blood back to the heart, because those the valves only allow it to go back in that one direction. But that means that you have to have healthy valves right here. And these leaflets of the valves only have a certain length associated with them. So when valves dilate due to vascular disease, the valves no longer can come together. Right, and that's caused by, and you see people maybe with varicose veins on the surface of their body. That means that the veins are so dilated that the valves aren't working, so that when skeletal muscle compresses the blood right here, how does it flow? In both directions. Sometimes it squirts to the heart, sometimes it squirts back down to an extremity, and people have big problems with that, with circulation when the valves don't work properly. No, they just like to remove that blood vessel, okay, and maybe transplant another kind of blood vessel, a vein from another part of the body, all right? But it also causes other kinds of problems. But you had another question? How do you treat varicose veins? Well, because fluid is going to be trapped in an extremity, sometimes varicose veins are treated with special compression hosiery, which means socks or shoes or something like that, which then prevents that appendage to swell up. Okay, so that's a partial treatment. But anytime blood is not flowing back to the heart, whenever it stagnates, whenever it stops flowing, guess what it has a tendency to do? Yeah, coagulate. So that's always a problem with somebody whose blood flow is not proper in their veins, and it could be due to veins deep in the leg or varicose veins, is that they could be generating clots, which can produce strokes or heart attacks. All right, and so a person with that kind of disease needs what kind of therapy, which we talked about? Anticoagulation therapy. And I'm really glad you said that, and not blood thinners. Okay, that's how we talk to everybody that's like on the street, but not in a physiology class. Right, we don't thin somebody's blood. Their viscosity of the blood remains the same. We just interrupt the coagulation pathway some way or another. All right, so that's one way that blood is assisted back to the heart. The other way is, think of the respiratory system. All right, so we need to inhale air. Air is a fluid, it's a gas. And air flows into our lungs and flows out of our lungs due to what kind of gradient? A pressure gradient. So how is it that air flows into our lungs? What's the pressure inside our lungs when air is flowing in? Is it high or low? Yeah, it's got to be low. And we'll look at that mechanism next week or the week after. All right, how the pressure decreases in our lungs so that air flows into our lungs. All right, but when you decrease the pressure in your lungs, breathing by expanding your rib cage so air flows into your lungs, what else are you doing? You're decreasing the pressure around your heart. And as the pressure around your heart decreases, what happens to blood? It gets sucked up into your thoracic cavity. So when you're inhaling, not only are you inhaling air into your lungs, but you're basically, you should maybe think of it as inhaling blood back into your thoracic cavity because the pressure decreases. So we call that the respiratory pump. So that's another important mechanism that helps return blood back to the heart from your periphery. So breathing helps, but the skeletal muscle pump also helps. And sometimes people, when they're not exercising, if they're sedentary, they can form blood clots because blood isn't moving properly through their vascular system. Like on long airplane flights, it's not unheard of for people to come down with a pulmonary embolism, which means a blockage of blood due to a blood clot that was generated in some part of their body because they weren't moving enough to get blood flow going in veins. So I've even heard of that on a flight from New York City to the West Coast, but probably even more common somebody flying from like North America or to Asia where you're sitting in your chair for like 16, 17 hours at a time. So if you're ever on any of those trips, what should you do during the middle of the flight? Probably not just take a barbiturate and sleep the whole time, but get up and exercise, right? Help that venous return via the skeletal muscle pump, okay? And as a matter of fact, in one of the Gulf Wars recently, somebody was too scared. It was a news reporter who was just too frightened to leave their armored vehicle, and he stayed in the armored vehicle for about 5 days, not exercising, and generated a blood clot and died of a pulmonary embolism. And I should actually do a Google on who that was. It was a fairly famous TV reporter. Okay, so moving around is important, right? Natural activity is very important just for the natural physiology of the heart. Okay. All right, so that's it for the material that would be covered on the test. All right, let's look at just a couple of these other last questions. All right, name the two mechanisms which help return blood to the heart. Skeletal muscle pump and respiratory pump. All right, and you should have a feel for how those work. Name the three types of cardiovascular structures that have valves. All right, this might be a little deep. I don't know. You should know at least two of the three right now. Heart has valves. Veins have valves. And then there's another cardiovascular structure that has valves too that transfers fluid around your body, and that is your lymphatic vessels have valves as well, because lymphatic vessels are very similar to veins. Lymphatic fluid or lymph has very low pressure. It doesn't like to flow from one place to the other very much. So skeletal muscle pump and respiratory pump for moving lymph around in your body as well. Which layer forms valves? Which layer of a blood vessel or the heart or even a lymphatic vessel is responsible for making valves? That's the innermost lining, which is in the heart, it's called the endocardium, makes the valves in the heart, or in blood vessels, we call that the endothelium, right? The endothelium. What's the difference between a sphincter and a valve? Ah, that's a good question. The valve that I showed you, how does it operate?
One way.
It kind of flops open, flops closed. It's just an endothelium. Okay, it's not active. It actively can't close. It just works by a pressure difference across the valve. So when blood tries to flow backwards, it will close. All right, a sphincter, on the other hand, is muscle. And muscle is under control of the nervous system, right? So it can contract, or it can dilate depending on what the nervous system tells it to do. So it's just not, the sphincter is not controlled by flow, it's controlled by the nervous system and maybe some other factors in that local environment.
So a sphincter can allow passage flow, correct?
And a sphincter is either open or closed, and if it's open, then it could be a bidirectional flow. That's right, that's another nice distinction between a valve. And a valve should only allow flow in one direction, no matter what. Okay? So a sphincter is like a gate, but not like a valve. Valve is just one way. That's really nice. All right, so that's it for this particular chapter. So the next chapter is actually kind of similar. Yeah. Yeah, you have some quantitative questions? Like what, calculate stroke volume or something? I don't have the study guide right in front of me. And you know, there's something else that I want to do too. You have a JPEG. You have a JPEG, which is not in the muscle chapter, which is in the cardiovascular chapter. Yeah, which is this thing right here. All right, so I'll post a key to this thing as well. But I don't want you just to memorize the answer, so I want you to work with trying to figure this out first, right, on your own, and then correct your work with the answer key that I'll email to everybody, okay, for the test. So this is a really good diagram to understand. All right, now the quantitative questions. Right now, I don't test your quantity, 38 through 42. I don't have these on the tip of my tongue. I don't know what these are. Yeah, I'll look through the quantitative and I'll send an email and then put an announcement in Blackboard, okay, for the quantitative answers, okay. But at the moment, I'm not familiar with what those questions are. Okay. I'm just not familiar with those quantitative questions. But since I have some there, then it might be handy to have your calculator with you. Okay. So bring your calculator. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I'm not sure I understand. So did I put the objectives down? Yeah. Oh, I want you to look over the web materials. Yeah, but the objectives. So your current edition is 11. All right, so those are the exam figures that I want you to know. And those are the objectives that I want you to know for Fox 11. Okay, not Fox 10. Okay, so I don't want you to know the objectives for Fox 10 or the exam figures for Fox 10. Okay, I guess I forgot to delete that. Okay. Yeah, the exam figures are these right here. Okay? Yeah, you have hard copy of the exam figures. Okay. All right, so let's just say the test is on Tuesday. All right? Test is on Tuesday. All right, some people came in late. Yeah, let's see. Hold on. Blackboard. And what do we want to see? We want to get to a physiology class. So here's a physiology class. And where do you find your study guides? Maybe under course documents? Is that right? No, that's power assignments. All right. And so for test 4, Ah, here is that. Here it is. So I right-clicked, and I'm going to save it as something. Should we put it in Dr. Ogoshi's folder just to freak him out a little bit? No, we'll put it on the desktop. All right, so this is that figure right here. All right, so just open it up. You can print it out. So this is the figure I'm talking about. Who had that question? This is it. All right, so it's under assignments. And this actually is in your lab manual. Right, and I'm sure maybe many of you went over this with your lab instructor already. All right, so I'll fill this in and put it in Blackboard as well. Oh, look, here's a little L. Oh, that's L. That's a hint. Okay. All right, so be familiar with this diagram. So this is the best diagram of all those cardiac function curves that we have. Yeah. 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 But work with it first, right? Most of it, there's probably two questions that you might have difficulty with. Maybe four, okay, that you can switch the answers around. But the rest should be pretty straightforward. You should be able to figure out, okay? But I'll post the exact answer key online. All right, well, this actually will kind of help you with the test, the first part of this chapter. So I'm going to start talking about, what is this, chapter 14? Okay, cardiovascular system. And the first part of cardiovascular system, we deal with a term called cardiac output. All right, and cardiac output is a measure of the flow of blood that is leaving the heart. And when does blood leave the heart? Anybody need the sign-in sheet? It's down over here if you need it. Okay, when does blood leave the heart? When does blood flow out of the heart? Yeah, when the ventricles contract. What's a good way of describing when the ventricles contract? That's during. Okay, remember the heart is cyclic in nature. It has two main phases. You've got systole and then diastole. So blood leaves the heart during systole. So that's when we would measure, for instance, cardiac output. All right, so cardiac output is just the volume of blood that's pumped out of the heart every minute by each ventricle. All right, so cardiac output is related to some parameters that we're actually familiar with already, and that is the stroke volume. Every time the heart beats, it pumps out a certain amount of blood, and we call that the stroke volume. How could you calculate stroke volume? Yeah, end diastolic volume minus end systolic volume gives you the stroke volume. Remember, end diastolic volume is what? The big volume. That's when the heart is dilated the most. When it's relaxed, it's filled up with the most blood. End systolic volume is the volume of the ventricle after it contracts. Subtract those two numbers from each other, and you get the amount of blood that's pumped out of the heart every time it beats, which is the stroke volume. All right, so in order to calculate how much blood is pumped per minute, then we just have to know how many times the heart beats every minute. What do we call that number? That's the heart rate. That's in what? Beats per minute. So cardiac output, right, so CO, which is in terms of milliliters per minute, what is this going to be equal to? It's going to be equal to stroke volume. And how do we measure stroke volume? Volume, how about milliliters, okay, per what period of time? Stroke volume every time the heart beats, right? So that's milliliters per beat right here, right? And we want to multiply this by heart rate. And what's heart rate? Beats, right? Beats per minute. All right, so we just do a little, I guess you call that a dimensional analysis, like in chemistry or something. What happens to these beats right here? They cancel out, and you're left with what? Milliliters per minute, right? Which is equal to cardiac output, which is the flow of blood out of the heart every minute. See how easy that is? Okay. The total circulating blood volume in your body is about 5.5 liters. Who's got a liter? Is that a liter right there? I think that, is that a liter? No, that's half a liter. It's about a half a liter. So quite a lot of blood in there. All right, so the way that cardiac output is regulated, or the amount of blood that flows from the heart, right, can be regulated by adjusting the heart rate or by adjusting the stroke volume. And the heart rate, right, the parameter that adjusts heart rate is what we call chronotropy. Well, I think we've talked about this. And things that adjust the force of contraction or stroke volume is what we call inotropy. All right. And the cardiac output, when we think of this little mathematical relationship right here, is cardiac output directly related to or inversely related to stroke volume? So if stroke volume increases, what happens to cardiac output? It increases as well. Right? If heart rate increases, what happens to cardiac output? It increases as well. So we call that directly related. Right? If it's inversely related, it means that if stroke volume were to increase, cardiac output would go down. But in that case, we wouldn't put these terms in the numerator. We would put them in the denominator of an equation. We would call that inversely related. So both stroke volume and heart rate are directly related to cardiac output. If either increase, then cardiac output increases. If they both increase, then cardiac output increases a lot by the product of those two parameters. Okay, so without neuronal influences, the SA node will drive the heart at a rate of its spontaneous activity due to what? Those pacemaker potentials, those HCN channels. Right? Normally, the sympathetic and parasympathetic innervation on the heart influences heart rate, right? Influences chronotropy inside the heart. Right? So both sympathetic and parasympathetic nerves go to what part of the heart? What affects the heart rate? The SA node, right? So both sympathetic and parasympathetic nerve fibers go to the SA node, and it adjusts the slope of that pacemaker potential to speed up or slow down the heart. All right, so autonomic innervation of the SA node is the main controller of heart rate. All right, sympathetic and parasympathetic nerve fibers modify the rate of that spontaneous depolarization. So let's take a look. All right, so here we see an action potential. And does that look like an action potential from a nodal tissue in the heart or a contractile tissue in the heart?
Nodal,
because I don't see that plateau region, right? If it was a plateau region due to those calcium channels, that would be a contractile cell. All right, so here is that pacemaker potential. And maybe, it says right here, all right, due to those HCN channels. In a normal heart, that's going to determine the normal heart rate. But under sympathetic stimulation, right, notice the slope of that pacemaker potential. It gets to be a lot steeper, which means what about these HCN channels? You have more and more of them opening, right? So it depolarizes faster, reaches threshold faster, and that causes an action potential earlier, and that increases the heart rate. Okay. So that's due to opening more and more of those HCN channels. With parasympathetic nerve effects on the heart, well, what's the main nerve, the main parasympathetic nerve that goes to the heart? That's the vagus, that's a cranial nerve, and you should probably know what number that is. That's number 10, right? So, and the vagus nerve releases acetylcholine, which promotes opening of potassium channels on the heart. So it doesn't adjust the HCN channels, but it opens some potassium channels. So what's the effect of opening potassium channels? That counteracts the effect of the HCN channels, and that makes the slope a lot less steep, So it takes longer to get to threshold, and so therefore this pacemaker of the heart produces what? A slower heart rate as a result of that. All right, so what we're looking at right here is just heart rate, which is what kind of effect? That's chronotropy on the heart. Okay. All right, now what about force of contraction? Force of contraction would be inotropy, right? Contractility. The cardioregulatory center, right, is in the medulla, and it coordinates all the activity of the autonomic nervous system. So it makes decisions on where to send action potentials, either out the vagus nerve or through the sympathetic nervous system. The sympathetic nerve endings go to the atria as well as the ventricles. So what kind of neurotransmitter is released by the sympathetic nerve endings right here? Norepinephrine, right? And so norepinephrine, right, opens up those HCN channels, but it also increases the strength of contraction of the ventricles. So sympathetic activity increases inotropy of the heart. But the vagus nerve does not go to the ventricles. So the vagus nerve has no effect on contractility of the heart whatsoever. It only affects the chronotropy of the heart. So here's a nice table that illustrates that. Right, so we have a number of different regions right here. We got the SA node, the AV node, atrial muscle, and ventricular muscle. Notice that the parasympathetic nerves have no effect on the muscle of the heart, whether it's the atria or the ventricles. It can't be a positive inotropic effect or negative inotropic effect because it just doesn't go to the ventricles. But the sympathetic nerves increase the force of contraction of both. Right, so sympathetic stimulation is a positive inotropic effect on both the atria and the ventricles. The only parasympathetic effect on the heart is by affecting nodal tissue in the heart, namely the SA node and the AV node, and that decreases heart rate. Sympathetic is going to be the opposite on the nodal and tissue because it increases the slope of those pacemaker potentials. All right, so here is something important for the test, right? Stroke volume. It's determined by three variables. The first two variables you're familiar with, the first variable is the only one that you're really familiar with so far, and then that is the end diastolic volume, right? Which is, what volume, again, is that? Is that the big volume or the small volume? That's the large volume, right? End diastolic volume. That affects the contractility of the heart, right? And so that's the volume right at the end of diastole. So in order to understand that, you have to know something about the length tension relationship about muscle, which is something that you had to learn about for skeletal muscle already. So do I have something right here? Yeah, I do have these pictures right here. All right, so here is a plot of stroke volume. This is the force of contraction as the heart gets stronger in its pumping, as its inotropy increases, all right, it pumps actually more blood out of the heart. The stroke volume increases. And this is plotted, stroke volume is plotted against end diastolic volume. So as end diastolic volume increases, what happens to the inotropy of the heart, or the force of contraction of the heart? It increases, right? So as end diastolic volume increases, the force of contraction increases. So this is really handy. This is just an intrinsic property of the heart. This is just the way the heart is made. So that as more blood flows back to the heart, guess how the heart reacts to that more blood flowing back to it? It gets stronger so that it can pump that blood through the circulation, which is really handy. Now, why is that? Okay, now, cardiac muscle, all right, has sarcomeres in it. So what are some of the properties of a sarcomere, some of the components of a sarcomere? What are the filaments? You've got actin and myosin, right? So here is the thick filament, namely myosin. Here are the thin filaments, namely actin. And How would you describe how this sarcomere actually shortens or contracts in by these different filaments? Okay, which one actually shortens? Neither of them. They do what? They slide past each other because of a special interaction between the myosin head groups right here can attach to actin. So in order for this sarcomere to get shorter, there has to be overlap between myosin and actin. If there is no overlap between them, all right, then the sarcomere can't shorten. And for instance, if the muscle is not stretched out at all, as in this case down over here, right here we have now complete overlap between actin and myosin, and the Z-discs are actually butting up against the myosin, even though cross bridges can form, right? Can this sarcomere get any shorter? No, because the Z-discs are already butted up against the myosin filament. So it cannot shorten. All right, so under this condition, no tension can be developed. And what we see, okay, is that in this condition right here, D, there is sufficient overlap, but there still is allowed sufficient sliding of filaments over each other that the heart can actually develop a lot of tension. All right, and as the sarcomere gets pulled apart farther and farther and farther, all right, more and more tension can develop from condition B to condition D over here. Now, under what conditions does this sarcomere get bigger and bigger and bigger? When do the Z-discs get pulled apart from each other? Think in terms of the heart. When? During relaxation, and what's happening to the ventricles? They're filling up with blood, the myocardium stretches, and as the myocardium stretches, it gets stronger because of the proper arrangement or alignment of actin and myosin with respect to each other. Okay? So as the heart fills up with blood, actin and myosin, right, gets stretched out, the force of contraction increases. And right at the end of diastole, what do we call that measurement? At the end of diastole, when we get maximum filling of the ventricles, that's the end diastolic volume, right? And so in order for the heart to beat strongly, the heart actually has to fill with blood and the ventricle actually has to expand and that produces a nice strong heartbeat, force of contraction. And one last thing I want to say about the length tension relationship, okay, which is what we call the Frank-Starling law of the heart, that says that as end diastolic volume increases, the contractility of the heart increases. That's really important on how we treat patients. I want to show you really the whole Frank-Starling curve on the board right here. So let's just draw a plot of the size of the ventricle during diastole, namely the end diastolic volume right here, versus contractility, and we can think of that as stroke volume or force of contraction. All right, so on the graph that you see right there, as the heart fills with blood and the ventricle stretches out, what happens to contractility of the heart? It increases, right? And you have a nice strong heart. But now as the heart fills up past an optimal limit and the actin and myosin get pulled farther apart to where there's no overlap, what happens to the strength of contraction of the heart? It actually decreases. All right, so then the force of contraction goes down. All right, so this is really the Frank-Starling curve right here. This is what we call the ascending limb. Here is the descending limb. And where would you like to live? Where would you like your heart to live on this Frank-Starling curve? Would you like to have it live over here or over here? Right here, during in an optimal region, so your heart is nice and strong. Okay, well, let's just say something unfortunate happened to somebody on their way home. They get into an accident, and they lacerate a big blood vessel, and they start to hemorrhage. All right, so there's blood all over the place instead of in their cardiovascular system, their blood vessels. What happens to end diastolic volume when you start to hemorrhage? You have less blood in your vessels, less blood goes back to the heart. What happens to the heart? It doesn't fill up as much, so the end diastolic volume gets smaller. What happens, where are you now operating on this Frank-Starling curve? You're down on this ascending limb right here. Your heart is getting weaker and weaker and weaker as you lose blood. All right, and that's really the worst circumstance for somebody that's going into shock or has hemorrhage, because you don't want your heart to get weaker as you're losing blood. You don't have as much blood to pump around. Your heart gets weaker. So on this limb right here, this would be due to hemorrhage. All right. Now, how do we help somebody that is losing blood volume? Okay. Even on the way to the hospital, EMTs have the ability to hook up an IV, and what do? They just start to transfuse just fluids. You don't even need blood, just fluids. And as your blood volume increases, what happens to your heart? It fills up with more fluid, right? So the sarcomeres start to get stretched. And what happens to contractility of the heart? It increases back to normal, right? So just by giving fluids to somebody, you can keep them from going into heart failure, right? But of course, they will probably need to be transfused with a real blood product soon after that. But at least you can keep them alive to get to the hospital. Here is another circumstance over here, produced by some diseases like hypertension. Oh, it's time to go. All right. Well, with certain kinds of hypertension, the heart starts to dilate. We call that a dilated cardiomyopathy. And as somebody's heart gets bigger and bigger and bigger, what happens to the strength of contraction? It gets weaker and weaker and weaker and weaker. Their heart starts to fail. Does anybody know what we can do for patients that are in heart failure because their heart is dilating, it's overfilling? What can we give for patients in that condition? A diuretic. And so they pee all that fluid out of their body. That fluid comes out of their cardiovascular system. Their end diastolic volume goes back down. What happens to contractility of the heart? It goes back up. And you can, like, snap somebody out of cardiac failure just by giving a diuretic to them. All right, so the Frank-Starling law of the heart is really important. All right, so that's it for today. Sign-in sheet is down here.